Tämä on Things Plus podcast yhteistyössä Arctic Design Weekin kanssa. Näissä erikoisjaksoissa haastattelemme vuoden 2020 Arctic Design Weekille kutsuttuja puhujia. Keskusteluun osallistuvat Things Plus jäsenet Petri, Liisa, Ulla ja Sampo vaihtuvalla kokoonpanolla. Mun nimi on Liisa ja toivotan sut tervetulleeksi mukaan.
Well, hello guys. This is Things Plus podcast, working together with Arctic Design Week, which is obviously now virtual instead of physical. But yes, who are you guys? And welcome to the podcast.
I'm Bastian. I'm from the Netherlands. I'm actually from a small farmer's town in the mid-east of the country. But when I grew older, I moved to Nijmegen, which is also the city I studied at. I have a background in business, and I specialized in innovation and entrepreneurship. And after that, I was freelancing for a while, and now I'm working at an innovation agency in Utrecht, in the middle of Holland.
Interesting. Looking forward to hear more about that. But then, I'm Lisa, and I'm part of the Things Plus podcast crew. So good to have you here, Bastian. This is going to be a super interesting conversation.
And I'm Petri. I'm part of the Things Plus podcast, and I'm a designer and do all these kind of fuzzy things when it comes to innovation as well. So I think we have plenty of things in common. All right, Bastian. I think the first question that I will ask you, which is probably the easiest one, is that how do you define innovation? What does innovation mean in your viewpoint?
In my viewpoint, I think innovation means coming up with new things, products or services or ways of working that actually solve problems for people.
Sorry, you broke up right there. Can you please repeat the sentence?
Yeah, sure. I think I can define innovation as a process in which we can come up with new things, new products, new services, or new ways of working that actually solve problems for people. And I think it's because back in the day, innovation was centered in, for example, an R&D facility in a company in which people would do research after research and then staple the new technologies or new products that came out of this. But actually nothing was done with it because these scientists, most of the time, didn't know if it was actually solving a problem for people or if people actually needed it. And that's why I think the more modern kinds of innovation methodologies are, in my opinion, more user-centered and more focused around solving problems to make the world better.
So can we basically crystallize what you said? In a simple way is that, I mean, previously innovation was seen as something like this, that there's a hole in the market that needs to be filled, but now currently it's more like there's a need with people, so which needs to be fulfilled. Do you think that's the difference?
I think you defined it in the right way.
Very cool. Lisa, how do you define innovation, Lisa?
I really like the kind of formulation you both had. I would maybe add that innovation is kind of a bit what you said, but innovation in its best form really starts with the people, in the sense that more than looking into what can be done with the resources available, it starts by asking what are the problems or what are the challenges, and only then starts to think about, for example, within the context of one company, what it is that we can do about it. Then, of course, kind of there's the time perspective. Are we talking about challenges that exist today or challenges that we foresee in the future, which is then the tricky part?
Yeah, I think time frames are interesting. Bastian, when it comes to your current work and day-to-day, what sort of time frames are you talking about when you're designing and creating products and innovations? What sort of time frames are you handling?
Well, we do not specify the time frame in which we do innovation work, but it really depends on what kind of problems we face, because we always start with a research phase in which we do a jobs to be done analysis, for example. So we make problem statements and we test them against the potential target group of such an innovation. And that makes clear in what time frame you're actually developing a solution later on in the process. But yeah, you cannot look in the future in that way, but we're not working on, how do you say, astronomically disruptive innovations for in about like 50 years, for example. It's closer.
Yeah, I think, you know, 50 years as a time frame is pretty impossible in any case, because I mean, if you look at what has happened this year already, you know, it's really hard to predict what's going to happen in the next 50.
That's true. Yeah.
So what about then? I mean, there's like probably like lots of like dimensions when it comes to innovation. One is, of course, you know, the change in behavior. That could be one dimension. Then there's, of course, technology. It's probably another one. And then there's probably all sorts of like layers like, you know, societal or corporate-wide ambitions or strategies and these kind of things. So which do you guys specialize in any of these dimensions, or do you need to understand all of them?
I think in the end, you have to understand multiple dimensions because we work business to business, but we solve societal problems.
Okay, that's interesting.
So I think from a business to business perspective, you look at the strategy. So how can this innovation fit in the long-term strategy of a company? But from the individual perspective, you look at societal change. And for example, when I was working at InnoBoost a year back, we looked at the sustainable part of it by working on circular innovations. Whereas now it's more work on digital innovations.
All right. That's kind of interesting. Do you think that, you know, in a way, innovation as a sector or as a like domain, do you think that it's siloed like that? That there's like these companies who specialize more in, as you said, digital or sustainability or societal or something like that? Or do you think that you guys are more like this general innovation guys? How do you see the sort of like, you know, fragmentation?
Yeah, I think we, as a company, Forty specializes in digital innovation. Or how do you say, we innovate business and use digital tools to do so. That's the angle we take. But for example, InnoBoost was really specialized in circular innovation, so more in the direction of sustainability. And I think if a company or a public organization tries to innovate, it crosses borders. So I won't say it's siloed per definition, but I think you should take a focus to really become good at something. Yeah, because like with technological innovations, you can also create sustainability, right? So in a sense, they affect each other.
Exactly. This way I asked, because I think, you know, when you look at like, you know, what is sort of like, you know, the horizontal and what is the vertical, let's say digital is basically, well, 99% of the cases part of the solution in any some shape or form, right? And technology is probably one shape or form, you know, part of it. So in a way that there's like, you know, interesting, I think it's interesting that is innovation like, you know, defined by the tools you use to solve something? Or is it defined by the cluster of challenges, which are then, they, of course, interlinked in a way, if you know what I mean?
If I know what you mean, I think it's the latter. Because you start at a challenge, right?
Yeah.
So you start, you see something when you walk on the streets, or you and you think, okay, this can be done better. For example, when I was on a holiday last month, I went to South Africa, and we were planning to drive around with a car over there. And for this, you don't necessarily need it, but if you have accidents, for example, with a car, then you need an international driver's license, right? Mm. So Mm-hmm. How we get this is we go to this ANWB. It's an organization that basically takes care of road support in the Netherlands, but they also give out these kind of driver's licenses. But then it's a piece of paper, and they have a small photograph of you. They have 15 translations or something in this piece of paper, and that's your international driver's license. And I thought, in this digital age, how is it possible it's still a piece of paper like this?
Mm.
Yes.
But then, you know, you start to wonder about these kind of things in everyday life. So you just come across things, you think, okay, this can be innovated. But then the next question comes, is this really worth innovating? Is this really a problem for people? And is this really something that's top of mind? Or is it a solution we can live with, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think that's the difference. So you start really making big changes when the benefits or the improvements of the innovations are really solving problems for people. And that's, I think, in business-to-business terms, you have to fall in love with the problem of your customer, because only then you can truly understand what keeps them busy, what kind of challenges they face in their daily lives, be it their employees, be it their customers, be it their users, and then start iterating, ideating on how can you actually solve these problems.
Indeed.
And then, kind of in a perfect world, that would lead to a salute to a place where the biggest problems would be solved first. But then, of course, what's worth solving depends on the perspective. That's something that, in a big scheme of things, might not be so important, might be important for a company who then wants to solve the problem because it benefits them.
Yeah, I agree.
It's kind of interesting. Yeah, definitely. Kind of interesting as well. Let's just follow the driver's license example for a bit. So you basically discover that there's a need or there's something that could be solved more elegantly and seamlessly. And then what happened next? Did it become a project, or what happened then?
Not yet. No, I'm still thinking this through. I think, the international driver's licenses, there's a huge political process behind it, I think, because it's based on the agreement within a political system, you know, agreement in the EU or worldwide about the validity of these kind of documents. So if you want to break through this, you'd have to dig through all this political, this whole political system, basically, to come up with a new solution. And for doing that, for the time and effort you have to invest in that, I don't know if the problem's too big or big enough. Because in the end, I took the piece of paper, I went on holiday, I didn't have to use it, and I threw it in the bin, you know? So.
Yes.
Well, that's interesting because, I mean, we could use this podcast actually to design a solution for that, because I think one of the biggest, I haven't researched that stuff at all. And to be honest, I don't even have a driver's license. But anyways, so I would say that, I mean, the data is super fragmented because, I mean, people's, like, you know, driving behavior and all these kind of things are basically like stored in like local country or nationwide, like storages and stuff like that. So there's a lot of probably integration work in there as well. But I think you will make some IT company very rich and very happy if you pitch this stuff and win it.
Yeah.
Mm. Then if we get back to who gets the value, then kind of the value in having information about the local driving data and the history of driving data of different drivers, and having that somehow fed into the international driving's license might be in the interest of someone, but maybe not the people applying for the international driver's licenses.
I know. And Lisa says that just because she's an international jewel thief, I mean, this really famous one, is wanted in several continents and stuff like that, so she doesn't want to leave a trace. But that's perhaps another story, I think.
No.
Another thing about innovation, which is super interesting, is this, that Right. And then you said that you will use empathy and validation in understanding the problem and understanding the basically pathways towards the solution with actual users and people, which is this basic like service design or empathic like approach. But then what happens? Do you guys like calculate any like business value or commercial impact or these kind of things in there as well? Or do you just leave it as, okay, this is what the people need, and this is the solution for the needs of the people?
No, we don't leave it there. Actually, at the company I work for now, 40, this name and the vision comes from a principle in Silicon Valley, in which they say to startups that develop a new product or service, they say if 40% of your users would be very disappointed if your product won't be there tomorrow, you're ready to scale up. And that's basically what we do with 40 as well. So we start at this problem phase, you know, to really map the problems, and then we look for the most potential to innovate. And then we have four other steps in which we try to come up with a solution, prototype this, simulate this, test it. Feasibility, it's viability, but also desirability. So do people actually want this? And every step we try to validate this before we move on, and we actually continue as long as it needs to get to that 40%.
Oh, cool. That's a really cool method. What about the competition though? I mean, if your system is so codified, does any all innovation agencies have their own framework on doing things, or is there some common ground between you guys?
Well, I think the way we framed it is unique so far, but I think the principles which it's based on are getting more and more popular because it comes from customer validation theories, it comes from design thinking principles, and it comes from the book of Eric Ries. Lean Startup. And I think there's more and more agencies nowadays that base their processes on steps that these books prescribe to take. And they tweak it a little bit, you know, but I think in essence, they're based on these kind of methods.
Because this is a conversation me and Lisa have been having for the last month or so quite a lot, is that in a way, innovation agencies or design agencies, or there's a lot of like names for the same kind of basically like, you know, output, I think. We all basically like, you know, want to have our own tool sets and frameworks. And usually when it comes to the customer side, they're using several different like, you know, partners, like different agencies and stuff like that. And then if each agency works on with their own cadence or with their own frameworks, then it becomes quite chaotic often. Which is why that we've been recommending with our customers, for instance, when we were pitching for some like, you know, innovation process design things, how to make the R&D of the company like faster and smarter and stuff. We've been currently like suggesting that these companies make their own system where the agencies then integrate, if you know what I mean. So we kind of reversed it. It's probably not the best approach when it comes to consultancy in business, but I think for the customer side, it's probably the optimal way of doing things. So how do you feel about this?
Yeah, it could be a good method, definitely. But the first question that came to my mind is, do these companies know how to innovate? And do they have the capacity and the knowledge to come up with the ideal innovation process? Or is this the knowledge that actually they try to buy in from those kind of agencies?
Yeah, that's the point. I mean, probably the like current like, you know, consensus is that, I mean, they will then, you know, so like, you know, assimilate some of the methods and the ways of working and stuff like that. But I think, you know, we can, you know, go a bit forward and further than that, that I think that the first project for the company should be to design their own unique framework. Because, I mean, also, I think, you know, when it comes to companies and sectors of business or for the public side even, there's no basically like, you know, one size fits all system to solve problems because the problems are usually so unique. If you would, let's say, innovate a new chocolate bar, or if you would innovate a new, like, you know, way of doing universal basic income, for instance, these projects are so different that, you know, this one set of tools cannot basically, like, you know, reach the nooks and crannies of the, each of the examples, I think.
I'm not sure. And how do you feel about that from a design thinking perspective then? Because I feel that if you test problems or try to validate them or test solutions and try to validate its fit with a problem, I think it's really about understanding the target group, right? And you can ask mm-hmm. questions. And I think that the really thing that matters is to understand what their reaction comes from and how to actually think that through in terms of your solution again. But if the solution is a chocolate bar or a digital platform, should it make a difference? Should it?
Well, I think, you know, in a way, the basic, like, you know, idea of design thinking when it comes to validation, empathy and prototyping, all these kind of things, that probably doesn't change, but the complexity of the system is totally different. Let's say if you would do the universal basic income compared to a chocolate bar, I mean, with chocolate bars, you need to understand different dimensions, like, you know, how to manufacture it, how to invest in new machinery, you know, these kind of things. Then you need to understand basically like distribution and all this kind of stuff. Basically, the dynamics are obviously actually more complicated than it would seem. But then it comes to this other challenge, the complexities are way, way, way bigger. Hence, I think that, you know, in a way, at some point, I think the linear processes that we see as design thinking or these kind of like, you know, innovation processes become like this stream. They come more like looking like, you know, I'm not sure what it is in English, but, you know, there's a big river and there's a river delta. Before the river goes to the ocean, it kind of goes into these different streams, like these hundreds of different small rivers, basically, before it reaches the ocean. That's what happened, mm-hmm. I think, when it comes to this solving these huge complex issues.
Yeah. Yeah, I think,
and each of these streams has its own,
right?
Sorry,
it's all about managing uncertainty and reducing risks in a responsible way.
Mm. Yeah,
yeah.
But then kind of going back to Petri's, actually, kind of the Petri's river flowing to ocean metaphor. Then going back to there, then. From a company perspective, the closer the different kind of small rivers are to each other in terms of methodology, the easier it is for the company to manage the totality. And that's the kind of idea we've been playing around with, that a bit of a kind of design system type of thing going towards innovation is that kind of, what if the company would have an innovation system that they would use with different kind of with different partners that would allow them to control the different smaller streams across partners. It's still to some extent been kind of a in the plans, but it's something we have discussed a lot.
Yeah, I think it's. I think you're right there, because. And the way I see it, if I go back to the metaphor of these small rivers ending up in the sea, just before it reaches the sea, it has this big stream, right? So I think that's also a nice metaphor for the change in how companies perceive innovation in the last couple of years. Because it went from closed innovation, so really internal with R&D facilities, trying to stack up this information and this new knowledge to eventually bring it out in the market. A more open way of innovating by, you know, collaborating or sharing research facilities with other companies, doing public-private partnerships, all these kind of things. And altogether, I think you can practice this and experiment with the kinds of methodologies that work best for your organization to eventually have this good innovation strategy for your company, which
exactly. And I think the ecosystems and shared R&D are the next big, like, you know, thing that we will be working on. And I think there's really big differences in when it comes to, I used to live in and work in Netherlands a lot actually, and I think the culture in the Netherlands is probably more open to collaborations than in many other places, I think. But I think it's coming everywhere. And I think, you know, it's a really good sign that, I mean, a lot of big companies are now hiring like this head of innovation ecosystems, whose job is to build like this collaborative, like, you know, frameworks and, you know, toolboxes and sandboxes, basically. And that's a really good sign.
Yes. Maybe a question kind of to you, Bastian. In the work you have done, when do you think is the right kind of, if when you work in the area of innovation with a company, when is it that the work ends from the partner's point of view? Of course, it continues at the client company, but when is the right moment for the partner to kind of leave it with the client? And how does it continue then, the work? How have you approached this at the companies?
I think because I recently started this job at 40, I haven't come to the point that we've actually reached the 40% at our client. Mm-hmm. Because 40 as a whole started about a year ago. And I think innovation is never done, right?
Because yes.
You have this difference between breakthrough innovations and incremental steps you can take. And I think if you plan for a breakthrough innovation, there's always incremental steps that you can take to further innovate your product or service. And I think this just never stops, because you should still pay attention to developments, to trends, and then try and see if this still fits the product you have out on the market today. And if not, you should go back to the drawing table and design a new solution, whether this is like a big step or an incremental step. I think innovation never stops. And to translate this to work for an agency, I think, this work never stops as well. And that's basically why 40 chose to make work for our clients really two-way traffic. So instead of really reactively only doing work for a client, we try to form innovation teams with people from our clients themselves. So let's say we have a team of one IT guy, one innovation guy from our client, and then a strategist, a producer, and a service designer from our side. We start with some sessions in which we create a roadmap for the company with certain innovation directions they could move to in the next coming year, for example. And then we prioritize these kind of directions. Then we choose some of them. Then we dig deeper in them. And then we start these innovation processes as separate projects. But then again, you know, we at the same time, we have our eye out for new trends and new developments in their sphere of influence. And that's when we iterate on new solutions again. So, I think the work never stops.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also when you look at all the, in parentheses, of course, breakthrough innovations, like in their life cycle, they go through different iterations, even like focus pivots and stuff like that. So, I mean, this stuff is never in a flux. It's kind of related. My next question is kind of related to what Lisa asked you, but I mean, let's go a bit deeper into this, because I think this is one of the biggest in the innovation scene, the biggest, like, you know, potential pitfalls. Because I think when it comes to innovation, I think one of the biggest like roles and challenges is to manage the disconnect or connect between output and expectations, or expectation and outputs. Because I mean, when people start these kind of projects, they're like super enthusiastic, and this is, everyone loves creating the new thing, right? I mean, it's always super, like, you know, shiny, and everyone likes it and stuff like that. But then sometimes in my experience, like, you know, when companies start to do something really, like, you know, disruptive or different, or break their current like ways of working or business models, the innovation like gets ghettoized. The innovation people then, you know, if the company doesn't have like this buy-in from this huge mass of people that everyone thinks that this is the direction we should take, innovations, like, you know, functions tend to go into these ghettos and become like this, not curiosities, but I mean, the impact is could be even more. So how do you take care that the buy-in within the company when it comes to changing directions or creating new things is given? How do you guys work with that?
So you mean that how do you manage the process of companies losing trust in the innovation process?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's all about setting a culture, right? So, take Philips as an example again, where they had these big R&D departments in the past. They've now developed this innovation culture in which they're not afraid to fail. And I think it's all about mindset in the end, because you shouldn't be afraid to fail, and you should, I think, embrace a culture in which you face uncertainty but can manage it pretty well. And with the work we do, we try to reach this level at our clients as well, because on the one hand, we create these scalable products and services, but on the other hand, we also try to create the context in which a company can actually do it themselves after we, for example, reach the 40%. So coming back to your previous question, this is also a way to actually manage that the efforts we do up to the 40% are not getting lost when we step out of it, for example.
Yeah, but this leads us into an interesting problem or challenge in our sector, because that what you're saying now then means that let's take your average designer, right? She or he has a really good, deep knowledge on a certain thing. Let's say service design, for instance, and stuff like that. But what you're saying is that, this person should also be a coach of some sort. So it's quite do you think that we emphasize enough as a competence or as a field of business that, our role is becoming more and more like this coaching function in addition to designing the stuff that we're doing?
Yes. I think I'm convinced of that. If I have to give an example, I was working on this startup for digital delivery and storage of parts, so metal parts, so in, for example, machinery industry. And it's basically all about the technological innovation of 3D printing. But I spoke to a lot of companies and tried to validate the problem they have. But in the end, it's all about business innovation, because the technological possibilities are there. But then taking the company on a journey to transform is the biggest challenge, I think. Mm. So if you look at 3D printing and you try to incorporate this in a company that's actually used to design in a two-dimensional way, you have to educate engineers in thinking in three-dimensionality. It's a big challenge.
What sort of qualities do you think that we should have? What makes a good coach?
Good question. What makes a good coach? I feel like a good coach, I think empathy is the most important thing.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm thinking of more ways, but I think a good coach should guard group processes. For example, we took part in this investor readiness program, and the coaches we had there, they really put much efforts in creating this feedback culture, which was really motivating rather than demotivating, right? Because some people can just, they can say something and they're not really aware of how this ends up at the person it's directed to. But I think by coaching it in a right way, you can build a feedback culture that's actually improving for the innovation team. And this basically
water.
At listening well and be empathic about these things.
And I think more and more consulting should include the kind of mindset of helping. It's always been there, the mindset of helping the people succeed in their work, but then actually coaching them and having that mindset that you provide the person and the team with someone they can spar their approach with and their communications with and so on is becoming more and more important for all partnering and consulting, because that's the way you help them succeed in actually implementing the stuff in their own work.
Yeah, I think I could summarize it from my personal experience or personal transformation journey, that let's say 5 years ago, I spent 95% of my energy to be the smartest person in the room. I wasn't, but I tried. And now I spent 95% of my energy to be the best listener in the room. and 5% of being the smartest person in the room, if you know what I mean. And I think that's one of the biggest, like, you know, transformations we've gone through as a discipline as well, that designers are not like these opinion machines anymore, because we need to be able to understand such a wide variety of different, like, feedback and, you know, signals and stuff like that. So basically the thinking has changed from me to the world to perhaps more like the world towards me kind of thinking.
Interesting. Yeah. But then you're pointing out to being a great listener, right?
Mm.
And I think that's where the coaching starts. I really try to save the, to basically guard the group ambience, making it safe for people to actually express their opinions. Whether it's a customer or an employee from a company, and then try to, I think, put the intelligence in the room rather than to the one that actually coaches.
Exactly, and then we can go have a beer and Genever, and then, you know, talk about how awesome we are to each other. So I mean, we can take care of the ego as well. It's kind of cool though. Lastly, I think, you know, what I think we should have a small talk about is that let's look at the dynamics of the moment for a little bit. As we all know, this is recorded when the coronavirus epidemic is like running wild, and the economic, like, you know, outlook of the world basically looks quite bad. For instance, today the Americans released the latest, like, unemployment numbers, and there's 6.6 million new people that exited the job market in the last, like, you know, 2 months, which is a huge thing.
Wow. Yeah.
And I think, you know, many companies right now are putting innovation and creating new things in the back burner. Of course, I think that that's totally the wrong strategy, because right now you should be able to start building the world after the pandemic, because, I mean, a lot of the changes that we are going through at the moment will stay here and stuff like that. But anyway, so how do you see in your field and in the Netherlands currently? I mean, are you able to talk about innovation to people and companies, or are they super focused about, like, cutting costs and, you know, making things as lean as possible?
Yeah, I think they're more focused on the latter. I think it depends on what kind of organization you are, because public companies, you know, municipalities and organizations like that, they actually need to innovate now. But I think, yeah, everyone goes back to their core business, because we see companies almost falling down because they have to cancel projects, you know, and they lose lots of sales and stuff because of the near lockdown we have. We don't have a lockdown situation here, but, like, lots of public places are just closed and there's nobody on the street. But yeah, I think they go back to their core business and try to manage the chaos and manage the crisis rather than putting money and efforts in developing new things so far. Yeah. How is this in Finland?
It's the same thing here. And I think herein lies the danger, because, I mean, there's two dynamics in this that I think we cannot, like, foresee. One is that we don't know how long this thing will last.
Mm.
And that gives us a big bit of a problem, because then we cannot basically front load what's going to happen after, right? Because we don't know when after is. I mean, it's simple as this, basically. And the second thing is that we don't know yet that the decimation of certain, like, sectors, like, let's say, the restaurant industry and these kind of things, or the travel industry and stuff like that, if there's going to be a bounce back or if there isn't, because there's no consensus really on that. So I think there's so many, like, variables of uncertainty here that I think that, in a way, our field is pretty much put on hold for a while. But do you think that there's something that we could do for that? Because I think, do you guys have a common, like, you know, voice in the Netherlands when it comes to people that work in your sector or in our sector? That, I mean, do you have a common voice that you can actually start talking about this stuff? Guys, you just shouldn't go lean now. You should be able to do the next thing right now and stuff like that. Do you think that your voice has gravitas?
I'm not sure. I think lots of agencies are a part of the kind of this overarching organization called the DDA, Dutch Digital Agencies. And through these kind of organizations, you might be able to express more power, so to say. yeah, but I'm not sure. I think that the real impact just comes to trying to find opportunities, even in crisis times like this, to innovate and really dig into the problem of the company itself to try and find to help them with the solution.
I also find that for some companies that have been a bit on the kind of waiting for the right moment or still playing with kind of doing some innovations or going some places that would have put them in a better place in a situation like this where everything is happening digitally. I think in those companies, we also already see now interest to speeding up things. So those companies, especially if they are in a place where they have a good cash situation, they might even prioritize that sort of development and innovation at this very moment, because they now see that the uncertainty that we see could be reduced by having better digital capabilities. And in that situation, I now see that some companies are actually moving even quite fast.
That's true. Yeah, and we will see probably a lot of like mergers and acquisitions or murders and executions as a reference from, of course, American Psycho, but anyways, in the field as well, because, I mean, the guys who have the funds, they can actually now clean the market. Lastly,
because I think you're right there that every organization is trying to create this digital twin of their organization. Now they see it has much potential too, especially in crisis times like this. But how do you guys think about the sustainability part of this? Because you hear a lot of people say, which is actually true, because we can digitalize a lot, and apparently this is working okay so far, without us having to cross the streets with our cars and trucks and flying with lots of planes every day, and it has some positive sides as well. So do you think like governments would really stress on the sustainability effects of these kind of crises when this is done as well?
Could be, but I think there's a paradox here. When you look at, for instance, the countries and their own airlines, countries still have their like national airlines like KLM and Finnair in Finland and stuff like that. Yeah. And these will be the first ones to be saved because, I mean, a country, basically, I mean, it still could be old kind of thinking or new kind of thinking. I don't really want to comment on that. But I think, there's going to be a lot of subsidizing when it comes to these industries, which are the biggest polluters and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Also, I think, in a way, when you look at, logistics and stuff like that, I think a lot of this change will be permanent. I think a lot of the ways that we will interact with each other will become permanent. We will probably question, for instance, the role of the workplace. This was actually going to be my last question. Let's go here. It's a good rabbit hole in a way. I've been talking a lot in the recent days with a lot of friends who work in the same field about the role of the agency. And I think this will probably speed up the process that in the future or in the near future even, our field will not work in the traditional agency model anymore. We will probably be more like this automated systems and teams, and we will probably staff teams according to these different specialities and stuff like that to address a certain problem or specific need. So in a way that I think the biggest wake up call that I had is that in my previous couple of jobs, we had these really cool offices full of design furniture and really good really good looking places. And there's two people working in there because everyone is A, working with the client or working externally. So what the hell is happening here? You know what I mean? So in a way, this is a really good point in time to question also the old ways of working that we have as a sector. Or how do you feel about this?
Yeah, I mean, probably you can. If I look at the situation now, we manage quite well to work digitally, but I think you can speed up processes when you work physically together, the simple writing things down, drawing things out, putting it on post-its and visualize this on the wall, and coming back to office and see it every day, sparking new ideas or innovation. I think this speeds up the whole process and actually makes you work better, but it's doable without, yes.
But going back to the maybe kind of to the comment, I think that I'm not kind of maybe offices for individual agencies, but I see here a possibility for then collaborative spaces where different companies can maybe come together. If we then go back to the ecosystem innovation type of thing, I think it's still much easier to meet people and get to know people and get to kind of share ideas with people you don't know very well. That's still much easier in the physical world than digitally. I just this week tried to get to know someone and meet them for the first time via video conferencing. And that's a bit challenging if you're kind of really trying to just get to know someone and don't have a really kind of business agenda in the discussion.
But I think on all the companies in the world, one of the most traditional, Ernst & Young, they have, do you, Bastian, know the wave space concept that they have?
I don't know. Wave space?
Anyway, so
Wave space.
Anyway, the basic idea is that, I mean, it's the most, like, you know, trusted accounting company in the world that they have, like, this innovation, like, concept called wave space. And basically how it works is that they have, like, these co-working spaces or product or project spaces when it comes to in their offices, where companies, their clients, and their own people can come and do this sort of, like, you know, interval. And then, you know, no one has desks there or anything like that. So it's basically just this huge, like, you know, workshop theater, the whole place. And I think this probably will be more like the future of even our, like, own, like, you know, offices and stuff like that. And I think it's a deeper change than just talking about what the office looks like, because this also will implicate then that we will work more and more in these intense bursts. And like this, you know, probably the cadences of solving things will become faster and faster and faster and these kind of things. And that's something I think that will be kind of permanent after the coronavirus. I think this will speed this development up. Well, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think so too. I think people try to find more and more creative ways to actually work together. And this coronavirus kind of forced us into, you know, using tools like Mural and Mira to put things on a whiteboard and have brainstorm sessions online and stuff like that. And I think, again, this is opportunity for agencies to, you know, work with companies abroad in a much easier way, especially in certain parts of the process. Like you mentioned with EY, you know, they can just come together in this online space to have a brainstorm session on the wall.
Exactly. Yeah. Interesting times. All right, Mr. Bastian, has been a great conversation. And I think now we are 48 minutes and 11 seconds in. And I think we should call it quits. But do you have anything you want to tell the world?
Do I have anything
to tell the world? You can say hi to your mom if you want, but I would hope that you would say something else.
Yeah, well, I don't know if my mom's listening, but in case she is, hi, mom. No, but what I would like to tell to the world, I think, is that this is also a time, you know, we've arrived in this fourth industrial revolution. And I think in this fourth industrial revolution, it's also a time to think about how we can create a sustainable future with each other, be it in terms of how you, you know, how you cope with waste, how you produce your product, or how you collaborate with people. And a crisis like this puts stress on this. So I think it would be nice to, in terms of sustainability, see some, how do you say? I think this is an opener for more sustainability efforts throughout the world and through globalization in that kind of areas. And I'm just curious about what we are going to see in the next couple of months as a result of this coronavirus.
It's a great message.
Yeah, it is. Can I give you a practical example?
Yes.
Of course, recently we've been using a lot like these food delivery services.
Yeah.
all this kind of milk and groceries and all this kind of stuff comes home in these things. And I've been using, think about this stuff before, but right now, because I see it so vividly, because it's so close by that, I mean, there's so much packaging waste and boxes upon boxes upon fucking boxes, you know what I mean? Yeah. I will probably call someone in the company that provides this service to us and say, okay, can we solve this in a more elegant and sustainable way? So this is one, I think, one really like small but good example on, if you have like this, you know, problem solver's mindset, being in a situation where you can, you know, reflect on the situation, actually push your juices like flowing, and then you start solving things. Mm. And this is, I think, would be the really good outcome from this.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. And we see in Holland, at least, I don't know how this is in Finland, but probably all across the globe, because we are put in this same situation with all of us. We combine forces in a way I haven't seen before in my life. And I think this is a beautiful thing. Now, there's many initiatives of people just helping the elderly or the, you know, all kinds of examples like this. I just hope this will be maintained after times of crisis as well, and that this could be like a way to form a new standard, you know, to just look out for each other a bit more.
Mm. Exactly. And let's continue this conversation in some other format, because I think we should come together as well as a, you know, sector of professionals, because I think we work too much from this one agency viewpoint in a way, because I think the problems are wider and more common, and I think even our impact would be bigger if it would, like, you know, to have a common voice more, I think.
Yeah, I agree with
question.
That.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, you
thank
too.
You.
Thank you, guys.
Things Plus / Arctic Design Week, superhero designer Bastian. This was our podcast. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Things Plus podcastin tuottavat Liisa Holma, Ulla Jones, Petri Lattu, Sampo Axelsson. Löydät meidät Spotifysta, Applen podcasteista, SoundCloudista ja kaikkialta, missä podcasteja kuunnellaan. Muualla internetissä voit seurata meitä ja jättää palautetta Twitterissä, Facebookissa, LinkedInissä ja Instagramissa. Jos pidit jaksosta, niin jaa se jollekulle.